Hey, it is Headwaters with your host, Malachi Koons. It's 6 o'clock.
Good morning. President Trump talks of military action and tariffs to intervene in Iran's protests. What's really happening in the country? We have analysis from Karim Sajjanpour in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. The U.S. government launched a year of celebrating the nation's 250th anniversary. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A video extolled American achievements and also made notable omissions. We have a review. Also, a man married his best friend in order to stay covered by health insurance. It's his response to rising premiums, which Congress has yet to address. It's Tuesday, January 13th. This day in 1794, Congress added two stars to the flag for Vermont and Kentucky, the 14th and 15th states. They also added two stripes, but later went back to 13. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Iran remains under a total communications blackout. Protests have roiled the country in every major city. News reports cite eyewitnesses who say Iranian security agents are using live fire on protesters. Reuters news agency is citing an Iranian official who says at least 2,000 people are dead. Some groups say the number is lower and in the hundreds. President Trump has threatened to attack Iran on behalf of the protesters. Javed Ali is a former National Security Council senior director. He says the Trump administration needs to answer a legal question.
What legal authority can President Trump rely on to conduct attacks against Iran for Iran's crackdown against its own citizens? That is not a direct threat to the United States, at least on my read of President Trump's constitutional authorities.
Last night, Trump also announced he will impose tariffs on any country that does business with Iran. He did not offer details. The president travels to Detroit today to address a meeting of the city's business leaders. His visit comes as the city opens its annual showcase of the automotive industry. From member station WDET, Quinn Kleinfelter reports.
Trump is set to speak at an invitation-only meeting of the Detroit Economic Club and is expected to tour a Ford Motor Company factory. Trump has frequently appeared in the swing state of Michigan, arguing his use of tariffs would aid Detroit's signature auto industry and help return manufacturing back to the U.S. Tariffs have increased costs for automakers, even with carve-outs for the industry. Trump also eased Biden-era emission standards and erased tax credits designed to promote electric vehicles. His handling of the economy is seen as a key issue in the state's congressional and gubernatorial races this year. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears cases today involving transgender athletes. The cases test laws that ban transgender girls and women from participating in sports at publicly funded schools. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
27 states have now enacted laws banning transgender women and girls from participating in sports at every level, from intramural to varsity to club sports, and from elementary school to college. Supporters of these laws say they are needed to ensure fairness in athletic competition and to prevent trans athletes whose sex assigned at birth was male from having an unfair advantage in women's sports. Opponents counter that the laws discriminate based on sex, in violation of both federal statutes and the Constitution's guarantee to equal protection of the law. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The states of Illinois and Minnesota, along with three cities in those states, are suing the Trump administration. They claim President Trump's agents are interrogating people without legal reasons over citizenship status and illegally arresting people. You're listening to NPR. The FBI says a Mississippi man has confessed to setting a fire at the state's largest synagogue in Jackson. Authorities say Stephen Spencer Pittman made the admission from the hospital where he's being treated for burns. He has been charged with arson. In vitro fertilization has reshaped who gets to be a parent. The number of unmarried women over 40 who are having children using IVF has grown by 250% in the last 30 years, according to government data. NPR's Pallavi Gogoi met one mother in Nashville.
Laura Terry was approaching her 40s when she gave herself an interesting present.
For my 39th birthday, I bought a vial of donor sperm, which is a kind of odd birthday gift to buy yourself, I suppose.
She decided to start a family on her own through IVF. That's how she had her two daughters. Terry got pregnant on her first try, Many women have to try multiple times with no guarantee they will ever get pregnant. Plus, there's the price tag. Each try can cost as much as $30,000. It's why IVF is out of reach for many. Terry loves being a mom and is amazed how holding her kids close can calm them, not to mention the joy of singing with them.
I love the Rocky Box.
Pallavi Gugoy, NPR News.
As many as 100,000 people in El Paso, Texas, may still be without water. A water main broke over the weekend, and city officials are still working to repair it. Some parts of El Paso remain under boil water alerts. Several schools are closed or also are under boil water alerts. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
My name is Mark Bjornrud, and I am now from right here in Bemidji, Minnesota, originally from the Iron Range over in Embarrass, Minnesota. Sitting and listening to Green Cheese, I felt like I was at home. All of the characters and the people that I grew up with on the radio right now and calling in. Like, I don't know any of these people, but I do know all of these people.
Hello, you're on Green Cheese.
Hi, I wanted to answer the question about the haiku and syllable pattern.
Yes.
Can I give a shout out to the Akio Islanders if they're listening tonight?
Sure thing. Let's find out if they are listening.
Hi, I'm calling about the AC/DC albums.
Yeah.
I've got Dirty Deeds Thunder Cheap.
Keep people-powered radio going with your membership now. Donate at KAXC.org. Thank you for your support.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump continues to threaten military action against Iran and says he is receiving hourly reports on the violence against protesters as Iranian security forces try to quash growing unrest.
A U.S.-based group called the Human Rights Activists News Agency has tried to track the casualties, which is hard given an internet blackout. But the agency says more than 600 Iranians have been killed so far. That number includes 9 children and 133 members of the military and police. After threatening to take military action, Trump says he's heard a response.
The leaders of Iran, well, they want a negotiation. I think they're tired of being beat up by the United States.
Trump said Monday he's imposing a 25% tariff on countries doing business with Iran.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is following this, and he's with us now to bring us up to date. Good morning, Franco.
Good morning, Michelle.
So the president says a meeting is in the works with Iranian officials. What can you tell us about that?
You know, I think we should remember that Trump warned last week that the U.S. was, quote, locked and loaded and would come to the protesters' rescue if they continued to be killed. Trump says Iran's leadership called after those threats, as you guys mentioned, and his team is working on a meeting. But he also said they might have to act sooner if the violence continues. Trump's expected to meet with his national security team today.
How seriously is the U.S. taking threats from Tehran to retaliate against U.S. or Israeli military bases?
Well, Trump says if they do, the U.S. will respond.
If they do that, we will hit them at levels that they've never been hit before. They won't even believe it. I have options that are so strong.
And Caroline Levitt, the press secretary, called Iran's threats laughable. She said on Fox News yesterday that the Iranians may be talking a big game publicly, but they're saying something very different privately.
So the president spoke of options. What are those options?
Yeah, Trump and Levitt won't forecast what they're going to do, but Matthew Koenig worked on the Iranian file at the Pentagon, and he told me the lowest hanging fruit would be a strike on Iran's missile program. Another possibility, he said, would be strikes against the security services who are leading the crackdown on demonstrations. And Koenig also pointed to the Venezuela operation.
And then finally, after the Maduro raid, you can't count out something more creative, some kind of special operations move by the United States or Israel, say directly against the Iranian leadership.
Kranich says it's not something you'd expect from a U.S. president, but Trump doesn't seem to be constrained by traditional norms.
Well, you know, to that end, though, the president hasn't made human rights a priority in his foreign policy, except in a very rare circumstances. So tell us a little bit more about what kind of deal or what kind of negotiations the president seems to be pursuing.
Yeah, he's definitely not put human rights first and foremost. But we should remember that during the first Trump administration, Trump did order military strikes on Syria in response to chemical attacks by the Assad regime. Trump said he was moved at the time by the images of choking children. That said, what Trump really wants in Iran is a deal that permanently prevents the government from getting a nuclear weapon. And Kranich, who is now at the Atlantic Council, thinks the Iranian supreme leader may actually be willing to agree to a zero enrichment deal, if he thinks it will help the regime survive. The next question, though, will be, of course, does the regime actually follow through with that going forward in the future?
That is White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
All right, we heard a human rights group mention 600 people killed in Iran. This morning, an Iranian official has been telling the Reuters news agency that about 2,000 people have been killed so far. Information limited, but some big numbers out there. So where is this all going? We've brought in Karim Sajidpour to our studios. He's here in Studio 31. He's been watching Iran for a very long time. Karim, welcome back.
Thank you so much,
Steve. It's really good to see you. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I just have to ask the bottom line question first. Does this feel like a moment when Iran's longtime government could fall?
It certainly is an existential moment for the Iranian regime, in that the protests are throughout the country. Collectively, there's been millions of people protesting. And the regime is obviously deeply unpopular. In my view, there's probably no country in the world with a greater gap between the aspirations of its people and the conduct of its government than Iran. It's essentially society that wants to be like South Korea, a government that behaves like North Korea.
So an existential moment. Do you want to add a but there? An existential moment, but...
We know from history that revolutions require several factors, obviously pressure from below, but it also requires divisions at the top. Regimes usually don't fall if they are able to stay united. So far, we haven't seen any defections from the security forces or any splintering. That tends to happen the more protests go on.
How much weaker are those security forces because of Israeli and U.S. strikes over the past couple of years?
Well, last June in the 12-day war, Israel assassinated Iran's top perhaps a couple dozen senior Revolutionary Guard commanders. The country was also humiliated by the U.S. war. And regionally, you know, their most important regional proxies like Lebanese Hezbollah, Hamas have been destroyed. Their ally in Caracas, Venezuela, Maduro, was just captured. So in the international context, the Iranian regime has also been certainly weakened.
I can also imagine Iranian officials, the surviving ones, looking around and asking, can I trust this person who betrayed the location of other people to the Israelis, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. It's a regime which has been deeply penetrated by Israeli and U.S. intelligence, and the Iran supreme leader is 86 years old. You know, he's someone who probably doesn't have the mental and physical bandwidth to be quelling a national insurrection for many months to come.
Does it seem to you, though, that the security forces have the firepower, and I want to use another phrase carefully, and the moral authority? And what I mean by that is not that I think that they're right, but that they would feel that they are right to crush protests. Do you think they have the ability still to crush protests in the streets?
You know, they have it for a limited period, in my view. It just depends how long these protests are able to endure. And at some point, the security forces may ask themselves a question which security forces during the Arab Spring asked themselves. You know, do we want to keep killing to preserve the authority of our dictator? Maybe we cut loose the dictator in order to preserve our own economic and power interests.
This is very interesting listening to you, Karim. I'm reminded of a saying by Ernest Hemingway about bankruptcy. How do you go bankrupt? His answer was gradually and then suddenly. Is that the way you think a government fall could happen? It's not imminent until it's imminent.
In a way, this has been, we've been watching a gradual collapse of the Islamic Republic of Iran for the last couple decades, very much like the Soviet Union in the late 1980s. Very few people still believe in the ideology of the regime. A friend of mine who's a professor in Tehran said at the beginning of the revolution, the regime was composed of 80% ideologues and 20% charlatans. Mm-hmm. And now it's the reverse. Huh. Very few people, even within the regime, still are true believers. For most people, even within the regime, it's economic and political expediency. But if they feel like the ship is sinking, I think many people would be willing to jump off.
Now we have a United States that is trying to influence this situation. President Trump has talked about military strikes. He has declared tariffs on countries that trade with Iran. What can the United States do that would perhaps influence events inside the country?
I think most importantly, it's thinking of offensive cyber capabilities to try to tear down Iran's digital iron curtain, because the regime has throttled the internet, it's throttled satellite communications, cellular communications, so the country has 1% connectivity. Very few Iranians can connect with the outside world and vice versa, and Iranians can't connect with one another. If the United States or Israel has the capacity to tear down that iron curtain, it's going to be hugely welcomed among Iranians.
Meaning that information could become a weapon in this.
Exactly. The other thing is that President Trump has put his own credibility on the line. He's threatened Iran if they continue to kill protesters, and they have done so.
Yeah, what happens now? Kareem Sajidpour, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
The International Court of Justice at The Hague has opened a genocide case against Myanmar over the South Asian nation's treatment of Rohingya Muslims. The hearings are being watched closely by legal experts for clues on how the court might deal with future cases, such as the one against Israel over its actions in Gaza. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
The case against Myanmar was brought by the West African nation of Gambia. The Genocide Convention gives countries a mandate to act against genocide anywhere in the world, even if they're not affected. Gambia's Justice Minister, Dauda Jallo, told ICJ judges this was not about esoteric issues of international law.
It is about real people, real stories, and real group of human beings, the Rohingya of Myanmar. They have been targeted for destruction.
In the fall of 2017, around 1 million Rohingya Muslims fled violence by the Myanmar army and Buddhist militias, escaping to neighboring Bangladesh and bringing harrowing accounts of mass rape, arson, and murder. Human rights groups have called it a coordinated scorched earth campaign. Myanmar rejects the accusations and says it was waging a counter-terrorism campaign against armed Rohingya groups. NPR reported extensively on the refugee crisis. Here's Michael Sullivan speaking to Rohingya mother Satara Bagum, who fled with her two-year-old.
Wednesday they burned our village, so we ran to another, she says. But the next day they burned it too, so we just kept going until we reached the river. But her husband and two of her children were killed, she says, along the way. Now it's just her and her daughter.
The International Court of Justice, which was established after World War II and is an arm of the UN, is allowing a 2023 charge of genocide against Israel brought by South Africa to go ahead. The case is still in its early stages. Israel has rejected the charge. In its 80-year history, the closest the World Court has come to holding a nation responsible for genocide was in 2007 in a case brought against Serbia by Bosnia for the 1995 massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica. The court ruled it an act of genocide but did not hold Serbia responsible. While the ICJ has no power to enforce its decisions, they do carry moral weight with the international community. However, a few countries, including Israel, China, and the U.S., do not recognize the court. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:19 and you are listening to All Things Considered. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for being here today. We appreciate it. And we would like to thank Beltrami Electric. They're a Touchstone Energy Cooperative with a mission to provide safe, affordable, reliable electric service. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. You can listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts me, Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch is for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. Tune in Saturday at 1:30, Sunday morning at 10:30, and today throughout our morning show, lots of nature, including Pam Perry at 8:40, where we will talk about birds. We do have a chance of rain mixed with snow today, partly sunny skies to mostly cloudy, 35 to 38 with breezy west winds gusting up to 30, falling overnight, lows from 3 to 10 degrees, and tomorrow 11 to 17 during the day, sunny skies, blustery north winds with evening lows 5 below to 3 above. Our question of the week, we want to know your favorite games. Maybe it's card games. Maybe it's computer games. Maybe it is board games. You can text us at 218-326-1234. We want to hear from you. We want to get inspired during these months where we might be staying inside away from the mixed precipitation.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The government has begun celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States. For several nights over the New Year holiday, a very tall, very thin video played on the sides of the Washington Monument.
America.
Giving a version of American history.
Our nation began not as an idea invented in the minds of men, but as a land discovered.
The video began with Columbus's three ships sailing in 1492 across the ocean blue.
He sailed for glory, for gain, and for God.
The images lit up all four sides of the monument, a swift walk through American history concluding with a look towards space.
And imagine the wonders waiting among the stars. And perhaps someday, our descendants will plant an American flag on distant worlds.
This showing caught the attention of people on social media, some of whom loved it, and also a historian who asked, what's missing? Jill Lepore is author of an acclaimed history of the United States. She had heard about this video before we called, and we asked her to review it.
You could maybe summarize it thusly. Columbus navigates by the stars. His light turns into Paul Revere's spark that sets off the American Revolution. That spark endures a new flame, becomes Edison's light bulb, and then very quickly we're off to Mars, powered by the brilliant, shimmering illumination of artificial intelligence.
What's left out?
Well, everything is left out in the sense that it's really a bunch of inventions that are about American power and America's destiny. There's no Civil War, there's no slavery, there's no civil rights movement, there's no Martin Luther King.
The text mentions the Declaration of Independence. It name-checks the likes of Ben Franklin and other inventors, but there's scant talk of immigration or immigrants. Native Americans are not mentioned, although one image appears to show Sacagawea, who guided Lewis and Clark on their explorations. There's a whole section on westward expansion.
Families and adventurers. Farmers. Cowboys. Miners, missionaries, each one driven by the timeless yearning to build a future by the grace of God and with their own two hands.
This video is a product of Freedom 250, an organization guided by the Trump administration. We asked the White House for more information, and they referred us to Kyle Barrett, a contractor on the project.
The big idea was, let's celebrate, let's make sure that this is nonpartisan, and let's give Americans something to be, you know, cheerful and joyful about, and ultimately something to have us, you know, thinking in a more positive light going into this next year.
Barrett said his company was first contacted in December. In just 2.5 weeks, they managed an extraordinary technical feat using 40 different projectors to cast images on all four sides of the monument.
They're very unique projectors. They only had, I think, 37 in the United States. So we had every single version of this particular projector in the country and had to fly in three from Belgium just to make sure everything matched.
And as for the text, Barrett says he was not the primary author. I've also talked with historians who had questions, who were like, why no civil war?
Exactly. I mean, even from my perspective, you know, I as an outside vendor, you know, I was kind of internally wondering about some moments, but they weren't really open with why we weren't showing, for example, MLK and or, you know, the Gettysburg Address. I'm sure they had their reasons, but what I was appreciative of the fact is that they never once, you know, we never even heard the name Trump throughout this whole process.
We reached the person Barrett identified as the creative director, who ultimately wasn't available to talk on the record. Obviously, an 18-minute video could not include everything. Still, historian Jill Lepore takes note of the assertion that the nation began not as an idea.
Because, of course, the country was founded on an idea, right? So, first of all, you have to ask yourself, like, what is being disavowed? And I'm struggling with that a little bit, because it's a wonderful thing that in a source of great pride to Americans, that the country is founded on the idea, on these principles, that we have a right to govern ourselves.
In a speech last year, Vice President Vance argued that America was, quote, not just an idea, but, quote, a particular place with a particular people and a particular set of beliefs. Other administration figures have been pressing the Smithsonian Institution to present what they view as a more positive story of American history. Jill Lepore is asking what this Washington Monument project suggests about government plans for the rest of the year.
It doesn't augur well for the capacity of this commission around the 250th anniversary of the nation's founding to bring Americans together around examining the story of the American past.
This video makes me think of a video that used to play in the Disney Hall of Presidents in Florida, which is of a similar length and has some of the same elements in it. Ben Franklin appears, the moonshot appears, and it's old-fashioned and patriotic and chokes me up and everything else.
April 12th, 1861, Fort Sumter.
But it also includes debate and conflict and Andrew Jackson, Trump's favorite president, and Abraham Lincoln and slavery and a civil war and disagreement and debate. That's all in there in a similar length of time in a patriotic video.
But the fundamental philosophy of freedom, the belief in the rights of the individual and the dignity of man, remained unaltered.
Stripping that out does not make the story better. It makes the story wrong, but it also makes the story worse. I mean, I am such a sucker for this stuff. You know, I wouldn't say that's true of every American historian, but like I love this country, and I find its nation's past achingly, hauntingly beautiful, terrifying, exasperating, heartbreaking, tragic, inspiring. But it kind of has to be all those things to have any shot at being real.
Jill Lepore is an author of A History of the United States. She had a look at the patriotic video that played on the Washington Monument as the United States begins its 250th year. This is NPR News.
From AI to private space travel to genetically modified babies, what technological advances will shape 2026 and beyond?
More people are forming close personal relationships with chatbots, sometimes even romantic ones.
The MIT Technology Review's annual list of tech predictions is out. We'll hear from one of its editors on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You
You can hear that story coming up at 4 o'clock today on All Things Considered here on KAXC. Have you formed relationships with chatbots, John Latimer?
I wouldn't know.
I'm not a chatbot, so.
Well, that's good. So that's one off my list. where would I encounter a chatbot?
You'd have to go on your phone or online.
So like my phone, if I ask it a question, I get some sort of a synopsis of the data that's available.
Right.
And
right.
I suppose that's as close to a chatbot as I get. But
well, and you could start asking it things like, hey, what should I wear today? Or, you know, like more personal things. And then you would become friends and it would know over time what you wear.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
That probably isn't happening. Me and computers, I'm sort of, it's a love hate.
Yeah.
If it weren't for the computer, you know, phenology would be just a total mess, just a hot mess. But, outside of that, and even in spite of that, you know, there are moments when, practically daily when I get frustrated with the computer and I just get up and go for a walk and say, you know what, I'll work this out another time or I'll work it out in a different way. I'm not going to aggravate myself sitting here cursing at my computer.
We had a great essay, I think you might call it, in our Season Watch newsletter this week. I don't know if you saw it, from Charlie, really addressing same kind of thing.
Yep, I did read that. Yeah.
Of, you know, it's a tough time in the world right now.
Right.
In our state, and getting outside, feeling small in a big world is what it's called.
Yeah.
And, I was running late today. It was one of those sort of days. Everything just was slow and then I saw how icy it was, so it took a little longer getting in, but I also saw the moon that was pretty spectacular.
Yeah, nice little crescent moon. I saw it yesterday morning and again this morning. You're going to have to get up pretty early to catch up to it now because it's getting closer and closer to the sun. It'll be, the new moon must be coming up here. This is what, the 13th?
Mm-hmm.
I would guess, just guessing, but sometime before the 20th. Probably around the 15th, 16th, 17th, somewhere in there, we'll have the new moon.
Looks like.
And then
18th,
we should have
new moon.
Okay, if it's the 18th, we should have a full moon first part of February, first, second, or third of February, maybe a full moon.
Yeah.
Yeah, good old moon keeps a nice record for us. I have been I've been down a rabbit hole about time and the moon and the earth and the moon. Did you know that we rotate each other? That the moon and the earth form a gravitational attraction to one another, and the actual midpoint of that gravitational attraction is about 1,000 miles below our feet. So about 3,000 miles short of the center of the earth.
Okay.
And we pivot around that point so that even though we think the moon is going around us, we are actually going around with it. And when you get into, you really want to confuse yourself, go look at the motions of the earth and carry it out, you know, besides the rotation, which gives us our days. There's the tilt, which gives us our seasons. And while we're tilting and rotating, we're also traveling through space in the solar system with our sun at a phenomenal rate of speed. I forget, I think 13 or 17 miles a second or something like that. You don't want to know because it'll make you dizzy.
Well, I was just going to say, is this why I woke up dizzy this morning?
Probably it right there,
it.
Yeah.
I always wonder, like, what's the deal? But now it makes sense. That's sort of always going on.
Yeah, you're always in motion even though you think you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So belt up, kids, and hang on. And that's probably good advice. You mentioned it briefly, but I got up this morning. The temperature was 33 degrees at my house, so it did not get below freezing overnight, which is really unusual. I don't know how many days there might be in January. If I'd been better at keeping those records, I probably could tell you. But Not many days in January where we have a low temperature above 32 degrees. It's not a common occurrence. But it made for, my deck was icy, my sidewalk was icy, the road was icy. Give yourself a little extra time this morning.
Even if it isn't icy where you are, other people think it's icy. So you gotta kind of watch out as you drive, you know?
In the best situations, it's just going to be wet, but it's going to be right, and especially because just about dawn, just about 7:30 or 8 o'clock this morning, the temperature will be at its coldest. Now, that's a normal sort, that's the average normal sort of thing. Coldest temperature is right before or right after sunrise. But with weather systems moving around, that you can have a cold air system kind of slide in on you and temperatures can fall throughout a day. I'm not saying that's happening today. I don't know that it is. But when you're when you're skating near the line like that, it can be wet one second and icy the next. So,
yeah.
And like as not, you're going to run into somebody who just moved here from Texas and has never driven on snow or ice.
Right.
And they're going to be very cautious because it's going to feel really weird to them. They're not used to having their cars not attached firmly to the road. So many of you Minnesotans are like, hey, whatever. You're just going to slide a little bit. Don't worry about it. Get the speed up. Let's get going. But yeah, bear with those folks. They're panicked. They're white knuckled. They're freaking out. And the best you can do is just give them a little room and
have space between you and the car, so you don't have to slam on your brakes. So you do slide and
get a cup of coffee before you leave home, and leave home a little bit early. Mm-hmm. Leave yourself a little extra time and just relax, and listen to Heidi soothe you with her dulcet tones.
Yeah.
Try not to get too excited when the phenology show comes on and you get to wanting to scream at the radio.
Well, I'm looking at the National Weather Service. So, there's fun things to watch and how they report. There's a exclamation mark today.
Oh, good.
Expect some slick road conditions for the morning commute, exclamation point. So, yeah, they're telling us, so high temperatures during the day, 35 to 38, but they're going to be falling. And by tonight, 1 to 7.
Oh.
So they're falling a lot.
Yeah, that's, 40 degrees.
Uh-huh.
That'll get your attention.
Yeah.
And it'll turn a lot of that water into ice. So I struggled to get some ice off of my sidewalk, some of that rain that fell last week, trying to break that up. And I had a few patches of bare gravel or bare cement, but this morning I didn't. So.
Yeah, it's looking like 20 to 30% chance of this kind of rain, snow going on during the morning into the afternoon with not much precipitation, and then temperatures dropping. 1 to 7, blustery north winds tonight, 15 to 30 miles an hour. Tomorrow, sunny, highs 11 to 16, and then evening lows tomorrow night, 5 below to 1 above. And snow's likely on Thursday, 1 to 4 inches possible across the region, 24 to 32 degrees on Thursday.
Still pretty warm.
Yeah.
This is January. Normally, this would be our cold month. Although we are 1 week and about 4 days, 1 week and five. Today, the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we are 21st, about 25th or 26th of January is historically the coldest day of the year in Minnesota. So regardless of where you live in the state, the temperature records are probably going to show the 25th or 26th as that day of the year that has the most cold temperatures associated with it.
And because of that, no, not because of that, but next, a week from Saturday, the January 24th, KBXE is presenting Ski Palooza. It's going to be at Three Island Park in Bemidji from noon to 3. You are invited to come cross-country ski or snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music, swap stories around the fire, or bring some food and or bring some food to share for a potluck.
Sounds like a good time.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to be in the cities next weekend. My niece's husband is having an art opening.
Oh, fun.
He is an amazing artist. He paints pictures of baseball players.
Oh.
And among other things.
Okay.
But he does a really excellent job. And his painting style is realism. So okay. When you look at these paintings, you actually sort of see that person and you know, as you might see them if they walk by you on the street. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited about that, and I will, you know, maybe I'll post that online.
Yeah.
So that if you'd like to attend or just check it out, it's in North Minneapolis, and it's going to be a kind of a interesting gathering.
Something fun going on today at King Elementary in Deer River from 3:30 to 5. You can build a cardboard sled.
Ooh.
They can be used in the second annual Cardboard Classic Saturday, January 17th, and the supplies will be provided.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Where do you suppose they sled in Deer River? I know where I would go.
Okay.
Blueberry Hill.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Doesn't say. Is there anything at this school?
Deer River is pretty flat.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Deer River is not, you have to drive quite a ways going out of Deer River in just about any direction other than northeast.
Right.
Where you run into Blueberry Hill.
That's where it is.
Everything else is pretty flat in the Deer River area. Maybe if you know Deer River better than I do, you can tell me where the sliding hill is.
Yeah. Texas 218-326-1234. We're going to be bringing you some talkbacks. We also got a text that came in yesterday from Boomer the Groomer. He thought, I'll show you the photo as we listen to National Native News, John. But all it right. was the first ever Minnesota cross-country ski trails on snow grooming clinic. Mm. Sponsored by the Minnesota Nordic Ski Association, hosted by Northern Lights Nordic Ski Club. It was on Sugar Hills Trail System. Hi, Heidi and John. I thought you might be interested in a gaggle of groomers. And you know some of these faces.
Here. I'm sure I do, them. Yeah.
People
yeah.
learning how to make those trails for other people to enjoy the outdoors. Cool, Boomer. Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Coming up next, we are getting updated from National Native News about Native community members in Minneapolis that held a press conference last week to discuss immediate needs, resources, and plans for the community and the care of the community after the fatal shooting of Renee Good. Stay tuned for that story. And student phonology today. We're excited. They're back at school, and we'll be bringing you some reports.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native community members in Minneapolis, Minnesota held a press conference Friday to discuss immediate needs, resources, and plans for community care following the fatal shooting of 37-year-old Renee Good by an ICE agent last week in the city. Members of Native organizations and grassroots groups have set up two hubs in Minneapolis for people to gather and organize. Members of the Native community are also conducting street patrols. Robert Lilligren is the president and CEO of the Native American Community Development Institute and a member of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors. He says the Native community does not feel safe with the federal presence, adding they're receiving reports of ICE interactions with Native people and detainment.
As a community, I know we are skilled at protecting our people, protecting our assets, protecting our non-Native people and their assets. And we've had to do this over and over again, historic.
Nikki Love is the executive director of the Tawahi Foundation and a member of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors.
We're all here to keep each other safe. And it's very important that we think about not just as Native nations, but that's very important, right? But also as Native individuals, exercise our sovereign rights.
Leaders say they're working with Native organizations, grassroots groups, and tribal leaders to address the ICE presence in their community. Meanwhile, tribal leaders across the country are raising concerns about ICE activities and the safety of their tribal citizens, including leaders in South Dakota, after the detainment of tribal members in Minneapolis. South Dakota Public Broadcasting C.J. Keene has more.
A statement from the office of President Frank Starr comes out of the Oglala Sioux tribe, says he is aware of reports of the detainment of four Oglala tribal members by ICE in Minneapolis. In the report, an Oglala bystander was able to get their tribal identities, but unable to get their names. In the statement, President Starr comes out, writes, quote, "All Native people born within the territorial limits of the United States are recognized as U.S. citizens by birth. Because I'm both a tribal citizen and a U.S. citizen, ICE has no lawful authority to detain me." In another statement, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Chairman Steve Sitting Bear writes, quote, "Our nation is a sovereign government, and our members are not immigrants. We are not subject to immigration enforcement on our own lands." He goes on to say that ICE activity is not welcome or authorized on the lands of the Standing Rock Reservation, and that unauthorized personnel will be escorted from the reservation. South Dakota is not immune from the recent wave of immigration crackdowns, as immigration arrests and operations have been reported in communities across the state in recent months. I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
Last week, a former White Mountain Apache police officer in Arizona was arrested, stemming from a 15-count grand jury indictment alleging serial sexual abuse and kidnapping. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, federal law enforcement authorities are now asking for any additional victims to come forward.
Carl Eugene Leslie is accused of sexually abusing and kidnapping three victims while on duty between 2020 and 2023. All are White Mountain Apache, and one is a minor. FBI Phoenix Special Agent in Charge Heath Yonke thinks there's others.
We have to be careful, so I won't be able to talk a lot of specifics outside of what's in the actual indictment. What I can say is we believe there are more victims out there.
Leslie's nearly two-decade career ended in 2024.
There's no preclusion of a victim coming forward, no matter how far it may have gone back. We just need to know who they are and the facts behind that.
Leslie has been assigned an attorney out of Flagstaff who declined to comment. If convicted on all counts, he faces up to a life sentence and a $250,000 fine. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. It is 6:46. Welcome to the Tuesday morning show. Thanks for being with us. We did get some information when you ask. People let you know. Our very own Jennifer Barr let us know that that cardboard sled
construction class, at King Elementary.
Right. The event will be off of Chase Lake Road, off of Highway 6, just north of town, the Deer River Sliding Hill, which you know is Blueberry, right?
We always called that area Blueberry Hills. Okay. So there used to be a jump up there, a ski jump.
Oh, okay.
And if you drive up to the top, you can get onto the, call it the Chase Lake Trails, or if they call it the Blueberry Hills Trails, but it was a wonderful cross-country ski area. Mm. I loved skiing there. I'm trying to remember the fellow that did all the work out there. Oh, sorry. Too many beers and too many years.
We also had gotten a text in from Kari, and she sent us these photo of some prints that were outside of KEXE yesterday. And there were no human prints nearby, she wanted to let us know.
Yep. Not a dog.
Right.
Looked like otter to me.
Okay.
The really nice impression of the otter's tail and the footprint just says otter. All of the mustelids, which are the otters, the weasels, the mink, the marten, the fisher, the wolverine, that whole crowd sort of runs in pairs when they run, you'll see two and then a leap and then two and then a leap and then two. So they come down with front and back feet sort of not side by side, maybe one just slightly in front of the other. That's kind of typical of them. I came across some weasel tracks yesterday that were in the same sort of arrangement, two and two and two. And I also had gotten a picture from Kavor Johnson, and he was right in the same area here and saw an otter and took a picture of the track. And his track showed the otter, you know, the place where they slide on their bellies, which is so cool. It's made me want to become, you know, reincarnated as an otter. You know, either otter or raven. They're my two animal choices for reincarnation.
Huh.
Or, you know, if I die in the right spot, they could have my flesh. It'd be all right with me.
All right, stop talking about that. There's a lot of things going on in our region. We're going to bring you some phenology reports, but want to let you know about Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District. They have their annual tree sale going on right now. Young tree and shrub seedlings come in bundles of 25, plus native wildflower and grass mixes are available. Order early for the best selection. You can find more information at beltramiswcd.org.
I have not Beltrami, but Itasca is the same. Many of the local county SWDCs offer the same program, and they're right. Order early, because if you want the top choices, you got to get in there, because they have limited supplies of some of the things, especially some that are, you know, more desirable than others.
Yeah.
But I've had wonderful success. I have nannyberry at my house. I have cedar. I have big blue stem grass. I have oxeye sunflower. And I'm trying to think. Oh, Jerusalem artichoke. Just a number of wildflowers that that I was able to pick up from them and stick in. This is now probably 15 or 20 years ago, and I have great patches of many of these now. They're the only ones I couldn't get to go at my spot, and it might have just been my own kind of resistance to doing the right thing. Turtlehead. I've often wanted to have turtlehead growing in my area, and I haven't been able to get it started. But I did have some plants and put them in, and they lasted a year or two and then kind of faded. But
we just heard, speaking of, we were talking about the icy weather out there. Some of the schools, area schools, are running 2 hours late today, including Deer River, Floodwood, Grand Rapids, Greenway, Hill City Schools, Nashua, Keewatin, and Northland Community Schools in Reamer. They're all running 2 hours late for today.
Well, go back to bed, all you little sixth graders. They're probably not even out of bed yet. Probably mom has said, hey, time to get up. Come on down. The oatmeal's ready. I'm not getting out of bed today, Ma.
Yeah, take it slow out there. We're expecting this drizzle and snow to kind of continue off and on today. High temperatures, 35 to 38. They'll be falling through the afternoon tonight. Expect 1 to 7 degrees. Blustery north winds, 15 to 30. Sunny tomorrow with highs 11 to 16. And evening lows, 5 below to 1 above.
Funding for Phenology Talkbacks is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Our Phenology Talkbacks are produced by our own Charlie Mitchell. And many of you are familiar with this segment, where we invite students from across the state to report to us what's happening in their neighborhood. And this week we have five schools reporting, and we're going to start with the report from North Shore Community School, located near Duluth. Darcy Rolfe and Lee Jackson are the teachers over there.
Hello from North Shore Community School on the North Shore of Lake Superior. This is the phonology report for the week of January 3rd, 2026. My name is Adeline, and I'm your phonologist for this week. January is known as the Great Spirit Moon, according to the Ojibwe. On Saturday, January 3rd, we woke up to a dusting of snow. That evening, there was a full moon. There was 8 hours and 53 minutes of daylight. The amount of daylight is slowly lengthening. On Sunday, January 4th, our area accumulated about 1 to 2 inches more of fluffy white snow. Also on this day, it was noted that the water in Duluth Harbor was starting to freeze. On Wednesday, January 7th, Ms. Jackson's class noticed the snow was very wet and easy to form into shapes. This is probably because of the temperature was 34 degrees and the above freezing temperatures made the snow a different consistency. On Thursday, January 8th, we woke up to a dense fog with visibility of 1/4 mile or less. The fog remained all day long. On Thursday, January 1st, Ms. Pearson Evans spotted 8 golden eagles at the end of Park Point sitting in a tree and 1 eagle flying. On Saturday, January 3rd, Ms. Urban saw lots of waterfowl at Canal Park, including a bufflehead, a harlequin duck, and hundreds of golden eyes and flocks of mallards. On Tuesday, January 6th, Ms. Young's class saw the tracks of a grouse walking through the school forest. On Monday, January 5th, Ms. Marcon's class saw a tunnel going into the snow with lots of leaves and debris spread out around the hole. On Tuesday, January 6th, Ms. Beagle's class found 3 deer beds in a spot where deer had been foraging for food. The forage area had lots of disturbed snow and leaves and muzzle prints where the deer had been searching for snacks. Ms. Beagle's class also found a dead mouse stuck in a tree. They are wondering if a raven stashed it there for later. On Wednesday, January 7th, Ms. Jackson's class spotted snowshoe hare tracks as they were out snowshoeing for EE class. On Wednesday, January 7th, Bennett noticed 2 small spiders crawling on a tree in the school forest. They were moving around and active, not hibernating. This concludes the phonology report. Have a great week and be observant.
Thank you, Adeline. What a lovely report. Lots of interesting stuff there. The Great Spirit Moon, at our house, it was cloudy on Saturday the 3rd, so we did not get a chance to see it, but you could tell it was a full moon because even with the cloud cover, it was fairly light out that night. 1 to 2 inches of light, fluffy snow, got pretty wet around the 7th when it got really warm. And dense fog. Yes, we had some fog here as well. I'm not sure if that was sublimation of snow to fog, if it went right from solid to gas, or if it, it had to have because there was a lot of moisture in the air that day. Ms. Pearson Evans, who must be an excellent birder, found 8 golden eagles at the end of Park Point and 1 eagle flying. Ms. Urban saw lots of waterfowl at Canal Park, including a bufflehead, a harlequin duck, which is a duck of the West and typically fast-moving waters. But when they start moving around and they're looking for a place to spend the winter, why, Lake Superior is there and available and a good spot to stop for food and rest. Hundreds of golden eyes. There are a few golden eyes here on the Mississippi River right by KAXC. And then a couple of really interesting notes. A tunnel going into the snow with lots of leaves and debris spread out around the hole. I wonder if it was a tunnel or if it was just the actions of a squirrel maybe digging down to recover some of its stashed food. Not sure. I wasn't there to see it, but that is typical of what happens this time of year. So you might want to be looking for that. I took the students out this last week when we were out in schools and staked out little territories for them and asked them to interpret all the signs that were in there. I said, make a hypothesis that fits the facts in front of you. And so they did. And it was quite exciting for me and for them. And one of the places that we had staked out for them was an area where squirrels had indeed been foraging for some food that they might have buried. Let's see. A dead mouse stuck in a tree. That, to me, suggests northern shrike. And the northern shrike is a songbird. It is not a raptor, but it does act like a raptor because it kills things like mice and shrews and voles. And it hangs them in trees because it doesn't have talons. It doesn't have strong feet. It lacks the ability to sort of hold down the body and tear flesh off. So it will oftentimes hang the victim in a crotch of a tree or impale it on barbed wire or maybe a thorn from, say, a hawthorn plant. But anyway, stick the thing to the tree and then let the tree hold it while they tear it apart and enjoy the food. So that was a nice little finding. Snowshoe hares. I saw some snowshoe hare tracks myself. And finally, on the 7th, two small spiders crawling on a tree in the school forest. And there are spiders that somehow manage not to freeze and to remain active. Jim Columbus here in Grand Rapids had sent me a note not too long ago of the same thing. He found a spider wandering around on top of the snow, and it is not unheard of. And I'm not sure of the physical techniques that they use to prevent freezing when they're that small and it's that cold. But they do, and